Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everybody. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on VBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Leo Lyons became a professional musician at the age of 16 and as a founding member of the band 10 years after, has been an onstage eyewitness to some of the most pivotal moments in rock and roll history. 1967, 10 years after, held a residency at London's famous Marquee Club and a debut album out on Derham Records, and the band were soon to build up a huge following in Europe. Fillmore West and Fillmore East founder Bill Graham heard a copy of the band's first album and immediately sent a letter offering to book 10 years after into his historic venues in San Francisco and New York. They were also one of the first rock groups to be part of the Newport Jazz Festival at Newport, and on tour 10 years after performed with Nina Simone, Roland Kirk, Miles Davis, and other jazz legends, brainstorming across the U.S. Their now legendary encore, I'm Going Home, was captured on film at the Woodstock Music and Arts Festival, exposing their jazz, blues, rock amalgam to an even larger audience of moviegoers who were blown away by the intensity of the band's performance when the Academy Award-winning documentary was released. Their 10-minute appearance in the film is an acknowledged highlight and established 10 years after a place in rock history. The band's albums are still available and all have reached gold or platinum status. Leo has produced records for such music legends as UFO, Procol Harum, Motorhead, and many, many more. In 2003, 10 years after, reformed yet again, this time with the new guitarist, singer Joe Cooch, replacing Alvin Lee. And for the past 7 years, aside from writing and producing, Leo has recorded 3 CDs and toured the world with 10 years after. In the summer of 2010, together with 10 years after guitarist Joe Cooch, he formed 170 Split, a new, exciting, high-energy blues rock power trio showcasing their combined talents. Leo and Joe resigned from 10 years after at the end of 2013, and to celebrate a new beginning, 170 Split released a new CD simply titled HSS, followed by The Road 2 years later. Their live shows have already proved popular with 10 years after fans. HSS play 10 years after classics along new material in their shows. 170 Split was formed to play music that rocks outside of the 10 years after box. Please welcome bass guitarist, songwriter, and record producer Leo Lyons to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Leo. Welcome.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for the build-up. That's wonderful. Hello to everybody. Hello to everybody there out in stateside.
Well, we miss you over here. You know, 10 years after has that reputation of sometimes, you know, being in Europe, you know, and doing shows across the sea. And another band that's like that is Status Quo. We never get to see that band either.
No, I don't think Status Quo worked that much in the States, did
no.
they? But certainly 10 years after did. I mean, God, it was a second home. I think, you know, in the early days we were doing like 30 weeks, 36 week tours, you know, 3 times, 10 week, 12 week tours of America. And of course, I lived in America myself for 15 years.
You lived in Nashville, right?
I did, yes. I went there, I think, 98. Yeah, I think it was 98. As a songwriter, not as a touring musician, but... So I've got a very fond spot for America.
Well, Nashville's a great place. There's a lot of great players there, you know, great session players, and there still are. It's a great town. What did you do exactly? You said you were songwriting. What was your process back then when you lived in Nashville?
Well, I was writing. There was a bit of a lull in the type of music that I was known for in the UK, and I was writing songs, and I decided that I would fly over to Nashville with some of my songs, walk up and down Music Row, see if I could get anyone interested, and a Nashville publisher gave me a staff writing deal, so I moved to America on the basis of that, and would go into my office every day and write songs.
After a
number of years before I went back on the road again.
How tough was that to, you know, sit down and just create music like that?
It's very difficult. I mean, the way it worked in Nashville was you would co-write with people because that gave you a little bit more stimulation than sitting there on your own doing it. And for me, it was a wonderful experience, a great learning process. As you say, some of the best writers, some of the best musicians in the world either live in Nashville or pass through Nashville. And I got a lot of friends and I learned a lot. Alvin said to me, "What do you want to move to Nashville for? You know, they're all great players there." And I said, "Well, that's the reason, Alvin." You know, I wanted to learn.
Well, Alvin was one of my favorite guitarists, and I was very fortunate to hang out with him backstage at in D.C. during the Best of British Blues tour. That was it was Alvin Lee, Eric Burdon. They had guys like Ansley Dunbar, Mickey Moody was on the tour, Boz Burrell, Tim Hinckley. It was awesome, and Alvin was such a great guy. He signed my guitar. He said he even played it for a while. He was fantastic on stage, and I was really heartbroken when he passed away.
Yes, it was. It was for me. It was a shock because, of course, he and I worked together. I think he was 15, I was 16. So,
right.
You know, goes back a long way.
It's very strange.
It was like the brother I never had, you know?
Right.
We fought a lot, and we argued a lot, like brothers do, but we always in each other's corner.
Very strange and sad the way he passed away, too, because it was supposed to be kind of a simple procedure, is what I understand, you know?
It was, yes. I don't know the details about it, and I really wouldn't want to talk about the details on a radio show, but yes, it was a shock. It was a shock to everyone.
Well, I like that.
It wasn't expected.
Yeah. He's very, very
good. I was actually on tour in Germany with my band 170 Split, and I got a text or an email, I think, from someone in the music business that said, "Sad to hear about Alvin." And I thought, what is this? It's got to be a hoax. You know, there's so many hoaxes right out, aren't there? I checked it out, and sure, it was true.
It, you know, all the legends, you know, that we grew up with, you know, I just find it hard to see him go away like that. You know, it is very tough. And I saw you in that documentary with Johnny Winter, you know.
Oh,
that,
yes.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm at the sharp end of people disappearing, you know. It's scary for me. You know, every other day, someone I know has passed over.
Paul,
I guess it's that age, isn't it?
Some of these guys are dying pretty young, too, you know, like the guys from the 90s.
That's the story of rock and roll, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
I'm 75, that's pretty old. 25 would have been old 50 years ago.
Well, there's still guys out there like John Mayall. He's in his 80s now. And he is.
Yeah. Right. Same birthday as me, 30th of November.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. I didn't know till I found out. Somebody told me.
John, I covered John here in Sarasota for his 80th birthday, and I got to hang out with John Mayall as well. He not only does he still play, but he sets up his own equipment as well. I mean, I got...
Oh, yeah. Yes, John's always been an interesting character, I think. And, you know, one of the first guys to bring to champion the blues in the UK, him and Alexis Corner.
Well, thanks to the Brits, they brought blues back. You know, it went away, and then the Brits brought it back, which, you know.
Well, I think it was a strange thing, because in 1956, some of those black American blues players came over to Europe, thanks to the promoters, German promoters, Lippmann Rau, like Muddy Waters, Howling Wolf, Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, and they were, we all idolized those people. We loved it, and I didn't realize that it wasn't the same in America. The radio was different. There was race radio, and that was all you heard it on. And I think middle class white American, young British guitar players and bands went over to America and played that, you know, what really is American heritage music.
When did you first, because what I understand, I talked to Kim Simmons about the blues and about England, you know, first being introduced to American R&B and that kind of stuff. What was the first time you started hearing, I guess, American music, rock and roll and stuff? Because what I understand, the BBC did not play, they only had like classical music at the time, right?
No, there was a radio station called Radio Luxembourg.
Right.
Which was, I guess you would call it a medium wave station or short wave station. You could only pick it up at night in the UK. And it was a disappearing signal, but they were playing rock music. So it was Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Elvis, that kind of stuff. And a lot of ballad pop, Pat Boone type stuff, but it was Little Richard and Chuck Berry and Elvis, Gene Vincent, Barrett Strong, that kind of thing, rock and roll thing. And then latterly, I kind of went from there into the blues. And I think Alvin and I were in Germany in 1962, and Hamburg was a port town, and a lot of American sailors were coming through, bringing, you know, black music, and he kind of got into that there. And the same thing happened in Liverpool. Any port town was where new musical stuff came over from the States, and it kind of spread from there. So
yeah, it's amazing how Hamburg always comes up, you know, back from the early days.
Yes, it's the university for a rock musician, I think, or at least it was in the 60s. I mean, we played, Alvin and I played there, I think we did 6 weeks there, and you play sort of an hour on, an hour off, 6-7 hours a night. You learn to stretch out the songs. It was great, it was a formative time, and without that, I don't think, certainly Alvin and I would not have been as successful as we were, and I could probably say that about the Beatles and many, many other musicians.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I tell you one thing, I love your band, 170 Split, and I gave the album tracks 5 stars, because I fell in love with the album.
Thank you.
Usually, I highlight the tracks I like on each album, and I highlighted every track on this album.
Which one have you got, right?
Tracks?
Which album do you have?
Isn't it called Tracks, the album?
Oh, Tracks, yeah, that's the latest one.
Yeah, Tracks.
Yeah, that's our 1, 2, 3, 4, 4th record, yeah.
Oh, it's incredible.
Oh, thank you. You must email me your address, or I'll send you the others.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. The current band...
We're enjoying it. I mean, the idea was, really, it's a continuation of my musical career. You know, the thing that Alvin and I started years and years ago, and I'm lucky to be working with Joe Gooch and Damon Sawyer, two great musicians, and we're having one hell of a time.
Well, you know, it's such a polished album. You know, it's very mature. You can tell you got some, your background is definitely an influence on this album, and
I suppose it is. I am what I am, and I play you know, from my heart, not from my head. And I guess it's me and two other guys.
Well, the
I worked in Nashville, you know. Mostly I was writing, but because I engineered and produced, I would do demos and things for people. And I remember one time I got a call to go up to New York to produce a record with Leslie West.
Oh, wow.
And I went up there, and I guess I'd been influenced by Nashville, because when I got there, Leslie said, "Oh, and you're playing bass on it as well." And I said, okay. And so I played bass, and I did the real tasteful thing. Play for the song, keep it down, change it a little bit in the middle, change it a little bit in the chorus, you know, a good polished bass part. And he said, no, I thought you'd play over the top like you did with 10 Years After. And I thought, well, there you go. So I guess that's the basis of my style, like it or not, playing over the top. But at least I think it's honest. I play what I feel. Hopefully I've got better. But
I think you did that much, much better. Not that you were already great, but you can tell over the years that, you know, how you know, you've learned a few new tricks, I guess.
Yes, there are so many great musicians now around, aren't they? I mean, you know, living in Nashville was a good thing for me too. But with the internet, you can watch a video of some guy playing and learn every lick that he's got.
Yeah.
I mean, when I started, it was listening to a record and kind of thinking, well, maybe that's what they played. I'm not sure. In a way, you develop your own style by doing that, I think.
How did you record this album? Because there's a lot of different ways to record nowadays.
Well, we always try to do it live. I mean, the thing that I think is most important with that type of music, and it does depend on the type of music, but with the type of music that we're doing, is to capture the energy of it, the spirit of it.
Right.
So we try to do everything as live as possible, and then if there's something wrong, just pick it up. You know, if there's a wrong bass note or something like that, then maybe we can pick it up. And just run a few takes till someone says, "I don't think I can do any better than that," and then that's the basis of the record. And, you know, in the studio situation, being a three-piece, we may augment it with in the case of tracks, we put a little bit of extra guitar on and had a guest, Billy Lissy, to put some Hammond on the songs. And that's how it goes. And from my point of view, I'd rather work as quickly as possible, because there are so many things you can do. You can disappear doing it, you know. And I don't like that. I like to work quickly.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, just let's get it done. You know, if it sounds good on the first take, you know, let's do it.
There are a million ways to do it. I think on Tracks we did two versions of one song. I think it was Tracks, or maybe it was HSS, I can't remember, but because we tried it two different ways, and put them both on. But yeah, and the songs develop, they change. We could probably go in and record the songs again, and they'd be slightly different. We did a little acoustic showcase last month when we were in Germany, and I thought that would be good. We could do an acoustic CD of those songs, and they'd be different again. So it's fun. I mean, what I'm enjoying is working with people that I really like and I appreciate as musicians and enjoying things, you know.
Right.
So that's kind of where we're at. I think this next year, as you probably know, is the 50-year anniversary of Woodstock. So I think what we're going to do with 170 Split is we're going to do the 10 Years After 1969 Woodstock set. So we'll do two shows, basically.
Oh, great.
We'll do that, and then we'll do our own thing. So it'll be like two bands.
Awesome.
I'm not sure who's going to headline yet, but whether the HSS will open and we do the 10 Years After second or the other way around.
Right.
I'll see what the fans want, but that'll be a fun thing to do.
Well, back to the album real quick. Some of the tunes I really liked, you know, that, like I said, I liked them all. Gravedigger, It kind of started like, it reminded me a little bit of the Allman Brothers, the melody, you know?
Yeah, maybe so, yeah. I mean, it's my father was a great digger. It kind of, that's
really?
kind of came up. I co-wrote the song with Joe and with a long-term friend, Fred Kohler, in right. Nashville. And that's how we came up with, you know, you think about the title, but it's about life, not about my father. But it's an interesting one. It's probably slightly different to right. some of the other things we did.
Joe's a great guitar player and, you know, great singer as well.
He's brilliant. He's yeah. absolutely brilliant. He's very underrated. And yep. one of the most, the person that underrates himself, I think. He's a very, very modest guy.
Some of the other track, I Grew Up on Muddy Waters. What a cool title to that, huh?
well, that's how it was, you know. Like, Muddy Waters and Newport was a big, you know, the album was a big influence on both Alvin and myself. And I just loved it.
Sometimes Joe can...
Love the energy of it, love the way, you know, it all came together.
Sometimes Joe can sound a little bit like Paul Rogers. I don't know if you get that or not. But
he would be incredibly flattered.
I hear Paul in his voice.
Paul's got a great voice. Absolutely fantastic. I know I've met him because I think when we in the early days when they were free.
Yep.
They did some. Actually, when before they were called Black Cat Bones, I think they did some shows with 10 years. Well, yeah, it was 10 years after.
Yeah.
So I met him, and I thought he was great, great singer.
Well, I love the album.
In that genre, one of the best.
Yeah, exactly. And I hear a little Bad Company in the tune The Game as well. I think.
Actually, I hadn't thought about that.
It's just a, you know, it's a track that kind of reminds you of those days, I guess, you know?
Maybe I'm writing from experience or the old. I guess 50, 60 years, I guess.
Amazing how time flies.
Listening to music, I guess you get.
Yeah.
You go back a long way.
Some of the other tracks, She's Got the Mojo is a fun track. It's a great boogie and blues song. Lonely, another one with an incredible guitar. Joe's awesome on Lonely.
Yes. Joe wrote that one himself, particularly.
Really?
Yeah.
Final Curtain's a heavy rocker. You know, it comes out right out of the gate, you know, rocking. Great song. Can you talk about the track You Can't Drink It?
Yep.
What's that one all about?
It's a lost love song.
Okay.
I guess that's all about. When you've got the blues over losing your woman. Most things are about that, aren't they? Most of the blues, you feel good, you feel bad, you feel right. sick, you've been lost, you know.
Very true.
Yeah.
I think Alvin Lee said a guitar is very much like a woman, only I guess the guitar acts nicer and better than a woman or something like that is what he said.
Well, they can both make you feel good. I guess a guitar, I don't know. I've always taken great comfort from playing music, playing guitar, you know. If I feel a little bit down, I can pick up the guitar and cheer myself up, so.
Yep.
And I think that's what music's all about, isn't it? To have some sort of impact. A song can make you feel sad, happy, or you know, in many, many, many emotions, I think. And when we play live, you know, you get that feeling from people, you know, that they're part of the experience and a very important part of the audience, I think. You know, we work and we always say it wouldn't be the same, you know, without you, you know, people
yeah.
people come coming along and joining in.
Well, I think the very more important thing about music, timelines your life. And that's you play a 10 years after song and you go back and say, yeah, I remember that. I was in high school and I know exactly what I was doing when that song came out, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right with any music that we've all experienced. And people say that to me all the time.
Right.
I saw you in 1970. Do you remember the song and so on and so forth? Quite surprising. And I'm always quite surprised that where people are in their lives, you know, whether they're judges, lawyers, policemen,
right,
politicians, or whatever, their music they've enjoyed at some time or other, the music that I've been involved with, and it's very pleasing, but it sometimes makes me think, what? Strange, really strange.
Well, you guys are, first I wanted to say, you got a really hot DVD out there too, right? Is it live from Luxembourg?
There was one called Live from the Rock Hall, Luxembourg,
right,
and then there was a TV show, Rock Palace TV. Those are the couple that were out. We really should have done another one, but because they're probably 5, 6, 7 years old now, but we haven't got around to doing it. And we attempted to do a live DV, and there were some technical problems with the recording, and in the end we couldn't. Actually, it wasn't the recording; it was the camera. There was camera shake on one of the main cameras. They didn't fix it down, and the audience kept banging into it, and they couldn't use it. So we do another one, but that's out there now. There's a lot of iPhone stuff on the internet, which may or may not give people an idea. I mean, to me, I sometimes freak out and think, God, that sounds awful, but of course it would on an iPhone.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's a lot of musicians are worried about that because it shows up on YouTube, you know, and
oh yes,
and the quality. Yeah, then they think you sound like that, and you don't.
Yeah. I mean, we do have a good sound, man, and most of the time, even on an iPhone, it sounds, or shall I say, it's almost representative of what we're doing. But no, I think a good DVD is long overdue for 170 split.
Right. You have a tour coming up, January 12th, I think. You'll be...
Yeah, well, it's a short one. I mean, we just come off a month tour. We were in Europe for the whole month of October, and then we've got time off. And on the 12th, I'm doing a one-off show with some Danish musicians.
Right.
Celebrating the Woodstock thing, and then the day after that, I'm doing two shows with 170 split, all in Denmark. And then the next major run after that is in March, where we'll be touring mostly Germany. And then throughout the year, we'll be doing festivals in various parts of Europe. And in October, again, we're on the road, for October and into mid-November, 6 weeks on the road. So it's quite a lot of shows. And I was kind of hoping that some US dates would come in. The problem is visas, you know. I'm not an American resident anymore, and every time I want to work, I have to get a visa.
Oh.
And there are two people, I think, in the American Embassy in London that hand out visas to entertainers, and you can imagine how long I wait to get a visa. So it was about 160 days.
Wow.
To process, and it's proved difficult. Last year I had some shows in America and couldn't get the visa through in time and had to cancel them, so we'll see. Maybe with the Woodstock Festival someone will say, actually that guy was there and he's in the Library of Congress, so maybe we can fast track his visa and give him a visa within 3 or 4 weeks of him applying, but we'll see.
You should have became a citizen. You could have had, dual citizenship here in England?
Yeah, I had a green card.
Right.
And I was a resident for 15 years, so I could, after 5 years, I could have had dual citizenship.
Right, right.
But you know, it's so complicated. You get to a certain time in your life, and I felt I had a home in Nashville and had, you know, family here.
Right.
And, I felt like I was living out of a suitcase.
Right.
I didn't feel as if I'd got any roots. And, you know, I was thinking, it sounds very depressing and negative in a way, but as you get older, you think about what happens if I shuffle off this mortal coil. I'm going to leave one hell of a mess for my family to sort out, having, right, you know, having a foot in two countries. So I decided that maybe I should, you know, move and give up my green card and come back to the soil where I grew up in, you know.
Well, you must like touring because you're still doing it. You still do a lot of it.
yes. It's a drug, really.
Yeah.
There's no other reason. I don't need to do it. I don't need to do it for a living.
Right.
People say, even my family are very supportive. They realize that I need to do it. But,
yeah,
you know, my son said, well, you could do what you like now. What do you want to do? Go on holiday, do this, do that. And I said, well, I like to play. I like to go out and play live. And so that's what we do. And I guess I'll do that until I feel that I'm not capable of doing it.
Yeah, there's a cut.
As long as people want to hear me play, it would be sad to go out on tour and no one come.
Well, the good thing about it, you're playing bass, you're a songwriter, producer, engineer, and you got somebody else singing, and you got somebody else young singing.
yes, that's right.
So you won't lose your voice.
That's one thing. I don't want to sing, right? But I'm not a very good singer, and that's really been annoyed me for all my life. I decided this year, actually, that I would have singing lessons, so I have taken singing lessons.
Oh, good.
Not to sing on stage, but
right,
so that I can present the songs that I write in a better format than I have in the past.
Sure.
And I'm finding that fun. I do like singing. My great uncle was a professional opera singer, so in a way, if it's in the bloodline, there's no excuse I shouldn't be able to sing.
That's right.
Both my sons sing, so it must have come through somewhere. Inhibition, you know, most people. Sometimes I surprise myself, and I surprise myself so much that all of a sudden I lose it again. But there was a time, I think, many, many years ago, when Alvin and I started out in a band called the Jaybirds, and
right,
we had to go into hospital with an appendicitis.
Right.
And we needed the money, had to keep going, so we kept going, and I did sing in the band for a time, but I needed at least half a bottle of whiskey to do it, and I think it may have been pretty awful. I don't know.
Well, it all starts in the shower, right?
It does, yes, yeah. But I think my wife would complain about the noise.
Well, I admire you for being also a great producer, and I guess you're an engineer as well. If you're a producer, I guess you have to be an engineer pretty much, right?
Well, not necessarily. It
right,
does help to be able to say, actually, this is the sound I want.
Right.
And to be able to do it. I mean, a lot of engineers, an engineer gets to say, he knows how to, the recording technique, and he knows how to get the sound, and he chooses the right paint, if you like, for the picture, but the subject of the picture is the producer oversees everything. The producer has to get the best out of the artist, I think. Sometimes the producer will write all the songs and tell the artist what to play, but I didn't like to do that. I worked with a band or an artist that I thought was really good and try and help them get over what they wanted to say in the studio. And, you know, some engineers become producers, and some producers fall into being engineers because of the frustration of not being able to get the sound they hear in their heads.
Right.
I was kind of one of those. I produced before. I always enjoyed the recording process. I've always had tape recorders, and I've always had a little home studio. But when I started producing, I worked with other engineers. And then I engineered myself, and now I've kind of gone back to working with other engineers again, because it's hard work engineering, and it's tedious, and you've got to be young to do it. I'd rather say, this is the sound I want, and let someone else spend the hours trying to get it for me.
Well, the mix,
I love engineering.
The mixing board is so, you know, complex.
Yes.
My goodness.
But I think the recording process has changed so much now. I know mostly computer-based. And you can cut and paste and edit and do all sorts of things. You can take years producing a record. Unless there's someone that stops it because of a budget or there's a deadline. I'm a little bit like that in a way. I have to watch myself. I always think I could get that better. That could be better. And you have to say, no, that's good enough.
Right.
I forget it. Move on to the next record.
Right.
That's why I say I like to work as quickly as possible. In, out, done. No second chances. No, what about if it? What about if, you know?
Yep. That's when you get in trouble.
You know, now it's like, oh.
Yep.
What about that bass drum sounds a bit weird. Oh, here's 300 different bass drum samples that you can paste over the track and change the snare drum sound and change this and change that. And yeah, you can do whatever you want to do. Thrill, that energy, that spirit of the music comes from the musicians, and you've got to, if you can capture that energy live, even if the sound doesn't sound pristine and perfect, it has something, you know?
Yeah.
That's why I guess a lot of us like the old records. If you analyze them and say, well, a bit loose, a bit sloppy, that guitar's out of tune there, and so on and so forth, but the energy, the feeling that comes through is what sells the song, I think.
I agree with you. Well, you produced three of my favorite albums with UFO. Phenomenon, Force It, which is my favorite, and No Heavy Petting.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And then I went on to do, what were they called? Oh, I forgot the name of the band. They did another band thing with Pete Way and Andy Park.
Right.
I forget the name of the band now. I guess they were really successful. but I did work with them for quite a while,
It's funny because one album by UFO was actually produced by George Martin, No Place to Run.
That's right, Well, there was this big thing in America, in the record label at the time, thinking, what we need is to have a breakthrough into the States, and we need to find, you know, a big name producer, because that will get the airplay. And
right.
That's how George became involved. And I was working with George at the time. A guy called John Burgess, who was another great record producer, was George's manager, and he managed me for the time. So I knew, I talked with George about his experience with UFO.
Yeah, UFO was a great band. They're still going on with different players.
They are a great band.
Yeah.
A really good band. I saw on YouTube the other day, I think from a recent tour, I was watching the band, and I thought, yeah, they're great.
I
think Phil Muggs, Phil said this is his last year, he's going to retire.
Oh, really?
Huh. Whether that's true, I don't know. But
I think I heard something about that, too.
Yeah. I haven't spoken to Phil for a while. Maybe four or five years since I last saw him. But the lady that runs my website runs their website, so we're always, Phil says to say hi, or what are you guys doing? So I kind of keep in touch with what they're up to.
I'm going
to
mention...
Ask me to manage them. I mean, around the time of Force It or Phenomenon, they asked me to manage them.
Oh, really?
And I did for a few weeks.
That
is a tough job. Management is a tough job. It's the dark side, I think, but it's a tough job.
I interviewed Vinnie Moore. Vinnie Moore is now in UFO.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, great player.
Good guitar player, yep.
He is, yeah. I didn't work with Vinnie. Of course, I worked with Michael Schenker.
Oh, yeah. The greatest lineup. Yeah. The best lineup. Yep.
Yeah.
I know you hate talking about Woodstock, but I've talked to lots of guys that played Woodstock, including you know, guys like Greg Rowley, who said the band was on acid when they did most of their songs. I talked to Melanie, I talked a lot, Paul Kattner, I talked to him. But one thing I wanted to ask, when you guys did "I'm Going Home," did you intend to stretch it out like you did, or what happened there? Because that was, you guys really stretched that song out. It was a great song, and I think it was the hero of Woodstock. But I was wondering if that was planned or not.
Well, the song was, how can I explain it? If you look at the Undead, 10 years after Undead record, which was recorded, the second record that we recorded, and it was a live recording from Crooks Creek.
Right.
Which was a blues club next door to the Decca Studios. And we used to do a show, and then we'd go on and do an encore. We'd make a song up, and it would be basically a jam. And that was "I'm Going Home," and the first time we recorded it was on that Undead record. And it was a medley of old rock and roll and a jam. Where Alvin came up with the guitar intro lick from, I honestly don't know. I think it came out of the air like a lot of things. maybe we were all artificially enhanced. That's where that came about. So it was pretty much a long song by the time we were playing it at Woodstock. And again, it was an encore.
Yeah, yeah. I like how he comes out. He says, "I'm going home by helicopter."
Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say, I like how he came out and says, "I'm going home by helicopter."
Yeah, and he was wrong.
They
stopped flying.
Yeah.
Is it right by helicopter? We had to go out by road.
Is it hard to keep up with a guy like Alvin Lee on bass? You know,
No, not really. I think I pushed him.
So it's your fault.
It was my fault. I think, someone said in a book quite recently, it looked like they were dueling.
Right, exactly.
And about to fight, and it's true, sometimes we did fight. Yeah, it was an energy thing. It's something we had, we had to, we had to play with such intensity, and we egged each other on, and I got behind him and pushed him. So, no, it wasn't true. It was just something we through the years of playing, we both started out, we both enjoyed the same music in the beginning,
Right.
Same roots, same basic roots, listen to the same records. It was like, that's how it happened.
Well, you guys...
It's a very rare thing, looking back retrospectively and objectively, it's a very rare thing. If you have such an empathy with a musician like that,
right,
it's very rare. And there are lots of others, I suppose, Jagger and Richards and Lennon and McCartney and to name a few, but not that I'm putting myself up against those guys, but you can see there's an empathy of the way that people react to each other.
But you know what?
Ten
years after was an incredible live band, and I'll be honest with you, I can't say that about the Stones. I was very disappointed when I saw the Stones back in, I think it was like 74 or 75.
Yes.
But I don't think they're a great live band, to be honest with you. I think there are more. There are bar bands that can blow out the Rolling Stones with their music.
Yes, I think the strength of the Stones was what they did in the studio.
Right, exactly.
For certain, and the songs are classic songs. That's their strength. I don't think they went beyond that musically. They that's the way they are. They're loose. They develop their own style, and I still love to hear their music. But I you know, I'll be honest, I've not seen them play live since 1964,
right.
I think that was the last time I saw them live.
That's a long time ago.
It is, isn't it?
But my two favorite albums by 10 Years After is it always been Cricklewood Green.
Yep.
And the live album, the double live album, which I
recorded live. Yeah.
I play that over and over again. It's like that and the Uriah Heep live album were probably my two favorite albums for quite a long time.
I think 10 Years After was a live band. Because it was all about energy and excitement.
Yep.
And perhaps we didn't recreate it. I think we were lazy. We never really rehearsed. We'd go in to make a record half rehearsed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And make it happen in the studio. Or try to make it happen in the studio. And at the time, I thought, I think if we actually rehearsed these songs and sorted them out, we could make them better, but then it wouldn't have been 10 years after, so.
Right.
And I was making records with other people at the same time as latterly going in the studio with 10 years after, and it was quite a different experience.
Some people need to see, there's lots of footage of 10 years after. And you and on YouTube and it's good stuff. I mean, you got the 25th anniversary of the Marquee Club in 1983.
Yes, I like that. I like that one.
Yeah, me too. And I saw a bass solo that you did on Good Morning Little Schoolgirl. You know which one I'm talking about?
Oh God, yes.
Excellent.
Everyone wants to hear that one. And we still do. We still do it with 170 Spin.
That's awesome.
Okay.
You're a great.
I'm trying to think of a way of doing it differently, but it always falls into the same rut. I can change the bass, but it still falls into the same rut. I can sit at home and work something out. Oh, that's much better. Yeah, I'll do that. And then the minute it goes wrong, bang, it falls into something similar. And sometimes I'm pleased with it, sometimes I'm not. But people want to hear it, and I'm very happy to play it.
Well, Leo, you're a great bass player. You really are.
Oh, thank you. There are some great, absolutely fantastic bass players around now. I think I was just lucky, but I'd say I'm an enthusiastic bass player. I love what I do.
Well, you're up there, to me, the top three or four of all time is what I think.
Well, that's very kind of you.
You know,
I appreciate that. I could probably list 100, but... a musician is either an incredible player technically,
right,
or a communicator, and you know, the two sometimes go together, sometimes they don't. Sometimes a musician that communicates means a lot more to people than someone that just stands there and plays something perfect.
Right. Well,
Hendrix, for example, was an innovative player, and absolutely fantastic, and sometimes he would be brilliant, and
right,
sometimes he wouldn't be, and I think that's what happens with a lot of great players.
I think you're right. Well, the bass player is so important to the band. I mean, a bass player can play in time is fairly worthless. And
I'd say you're only as good as your drummer.
Yeah, exactly. Only as good as your drummer.
I mean, drums are probably more important now than they were, because the style or sounds sonically now, the drums are much more up front in the mix, aren't they?
Yes.
If you listen to the old rock and roll records,
right,
you didn't really hear the bass drum that much.
Exactly.
Had a nice snare drum, and then the bass was taking the groove. But now it's kind of switched around a little bit, and now the drums are up in the front, and the bass is playing with the drums. So, yeah.
Well, you can't have a drummer without a bass player.
Yeah. I think you could probably get away with a bit more... few more mistakes on bass than you could on drums nowadays.
Yeah, I think you're right. You worked with Lemmy as well, didn't you? Didn't you produce
Yes, for a brief period of time.
Yeah.
We went in the studio to make a record, and the record company didn't pay the bill, and the company went bust, and the album was shelved.
Oh, really? Huh. I didn't hear that story.
That's what happened, yeah.
Wow.
Lemmy was quite a character to work with, for sure. He could be very intimidating.
Really?
But to be honest, he didn't intimidate me, because he said to me before we even worked together that he was a big fan of my playing, blah, 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 blah. So, but it was okay.
I heard that a little bit about Ginger Baker as well.
Ginger, I wouldn't want to tackle.
I talked to Jack.
He called me up once, many, many years ago, when I'd finished with 10 years after, and he said, I want to put a band together. Do you fancy being in the band? And I thought, well, not from what, I'm not really sure, Ginger. And he said, oh, well, yeah, let's get together. We'll go to Dingwalls, which is a club in London.
Right.
And when the club closes about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, we'll all get together and play. And I thought, it sounds like it's a crazy thing. And you know, we've all seen the Mr. Baker film. So I think it's probably a good. I don't think I would have lasted very long with Ginger.
Yeah, probably not mesh very well, right?
No, but quite a character, I will say that.
Yeah, Jack Bruce told me.
Him and Jack playing.
Yeah.
I guess 1960, playing together in 1960, backing pop artists.
Right.
And they're both jazz players, as you know.
Yeah, Jack told me, I interviewed him the year before he passed away. He says that he didn't have a sense of humor at all.
Ginger didn't.
Right, Ginger didn't have a sense of humor. Jack was funny.
I can believe that. I mean, I didn't know. I worked with Cream a few times, but I didn't really know them.
Jack was actually pretty funny. I didn't know he was so funny, but he was a character.
Yeah, yeah. A very talented player, too.
Very.
They all were, but
very talented.
Jack was a great bass player.
Yeah. I understand you're into a couple of different things. I read that you like the paranormal, alternative medicine, and
well, it's a weird story. I've always been psychic. Sounds a terrible word. When I was young, I saw ghosts.
Really?
Well, I thought were ghosts, which actually were. But I had to come to terms with it. And I was always afraid of the dark as a kid. And
right.
I lived in a horribly haunted house, basically, and I was seeing things that nobody was talking about in the family. Mm. Which left me slightly afraid of the dark until I was in my 20s.
Right.
And I decided I had to come to terms with it, so I enrolled at a college in London called the College of Psychic Studies, just to learn what it was that was happening to me. Excuse me. One of the joys of living in Wales right now is the cough going around.
Huh.
So yes, I had an interest in the paranormal.
When you say you saw ghosts, what is it, just an apparition of somebody? Was it somebody you knew, or...?
No. I've seen all sorts of things throughout my life, but this
really?
Was a horribly haunted house.
Uh-huh.
When you're an entity that frightened the life out of me.
Wow.
It wasn't until I was in my 20s that I found out that the whole family were experiencing the same thing.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, so it corroborated it. Just when I convinced myself that I was imagining it, they confirmed it eventually. So I learned to come to terms with it. I it's like a radio. If you imagine a radio tuning, spinning around the dials, picking up this program, that program, and every other program.
Right.
That's what the psychic does. I learned to turn off the radio.
Yeah.
Although it's there, it doesn't bother me anymore. I've come to terms with it.
That's interesting.
I even did Coast to Coast. You know the radio show?
Oh, yeah.
Coast to Coast.
Yeah, the guy just passed away, right? The announcer?
He did, yes.
Yeah.
He hasn't been in touch with me since, but I did his show,
How about that? Huh, I didn't know that.
And one or two others across America. But once every 2 years, some psychic show in America calls me up and we do a psychic interview. which goes more into that side of my life than the musical side.
There's a TV show that does that too. They get celebrities and they go back, people like you that had an experience and are still very kind of, you know, very scared of that situation. Then they go back to the scene and they recreate it.
That, oh, really?
Yeah. I'll email you the link if I can.
That's interesting because 15 years ago, someone said to me, I've got this idea for a TV show where you go and you go to a celebrity that's been troubled, lives in a haunted house or something, and we do this TV show of you finding out what it is and helping them.
Right.
So I guess it's something like that.
It is. It's exactly like that.
Golly.
I'll send you the
how
link.
Do they do it?
I'm trying to think of some of the people that were on there, but they were famous people, and they were like you. They were dead serious afraid.
Well, you know, you've got to experience it yourself and then question what you've seen and make up your own mind.
Right.
You can't persuade someone one way or the other. And it took me years. I spent many, many years convincing myself that I was imagining things.
Right.
Actually, the early part of my life, I thought I was going mad.
Yeah.
You know, when I was 14 or 15, and none of my friends was, you know, seeing these things. But then, you know, when I went to the College of Psychic Studies, and I realized that I wasn't alone, and mm-hmm. it was, in a way, quite normal. And now I think people are more open to it. When I was younger, if you started talking the way I'm talking now, people would go, oh,
right.
This guy's a bit crazy, too much dope. And in actual fact, he put me off. You know, I thought, if I'm seeing these things, the last thing I want to do is to start, you know, tripping on acid.
Yeah, definitely don't want to do that.
So that was it. And, you know, going back to Woodstock, there was plenty of acid around.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I flew in from the Holiday Inn by helicopter and before we played and got down there, and I was sitting there in the back of a U-Haul truck, and Pete Townsend came over to me and said, whatever you do, don't eat anything or don't drink anything that's not from a sealed can, because I did it last night, and I got tripped out on acid. So I thought, God, I was hungry, but I stayed hungry. Yeah, there was a lot of it. You know, you've seen the movie. Watch out for the brown acid.
Yeah, I remember that. You know,
strange times.
Corky, you know Corky Lang, right?
Mm-hmm.
He says he on the Woodstock album, I think the album itself, they called him in to do the drums on I'm Going Home because they had a problem with the sound or something. Do you know anything about that?
I've heard it, yeah. I've heard it, and Corky's told me.
Yeah.
That they lost the snare drum mic.
Right, exactly.
It's difficult to tell because I've actually got the tape. I've got a rough two-track tape from Woodstock. And quite recently, they've discovered the eight-track tapes of the 10 years after Sad.
Hmm.
And I've not got around to checking whether the snare was overdubbed or not yet. But he may have been. He may have been. Rick denies it, but I don't know.
Yeah, he says he was the only guy at Woodstock that wasn't really at Woodstock.
Yeah. Well, that's his claim to fame, isn't it?
That's his claim to fame.
I honestly don't know. I think he said he went into RCA and dubbed the snare.
Right. Yeah, that's what he told me.
Yeah.
I'm
sure he probably did.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
But I'd have to listen to the 8-track. In fact, I know someone that's got the 8-track. I'll ask them.
Okay.
I think the snare was overdubbed, and
we can settle that
one way or the other on that one. Not that it detracts anything from Rick's playing, but
right.
Rick is not happy if that's suggested. It's like saying somebody dubbed my bass, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, come on, that's not really very fair.
I want to go back to the paranormal stuff just a minute. I want to bring up UFOs. I had a lengthy talk with Michael Pinder, you know, from the Moody Blues, and he saw a lot of stuff. He saw like a bunch of ships, you know, kind of like spaceships up in the air. And I mean, two or three times he saw UFOs, which are
I think we'd be pretty arrogant to think that we're the only form of intelligence in the universe,
right?
We?
Yeah, I think so.
So yeah, I'm open to it. I think I've experienced that twice in my life, seeing what I thought was a UFO.
Right. Was that in England or in the States?
Once in England, right. And once in the Sierra Nevada mountains outside of Fresno.
Oh, that would make sense.
I was camping out there, and this thing came hovering down over one of the lakes.
Huh.
Whether it was one of those things from Area 51 or whatever it is,
right.
An Army Air Force test plane or not, I don't know, but it sounded exactly the same as the one I heard in the UK.
Huh.
Like an electric motor.
Right, right.
Almost as if you turn an electric motor up and then turn it down like a volume. That's the way it's kind of sounded. But I haven't seen aliens as such, or not that I know. They say they walk amongst us, so maybe we all have and don't know.
Yeah, they probably look like us, pretty much, you know. Or
I think they do. Yeah, I think some of them are running the government.
I think you're right.
Yeah. That's gotta be. Something's happening in the world. I don't know what.
Something is happening in the world. It's been happening for the good, 6-7 years, very strange things. I don't know.
Yes.
Leo, here's a question I ask everybody, and I get some interesting answers. If you had a Field of Dreams wish like the movie, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
That is a difficult question. I think I'd like to have been in Memphis around the time the Sun Sessions were happening.
Right, right.
I think that would have been an interesting period. I mean, I was fortunate enough in moving to Nashville, really, to meet a few people that were around at the time and involved in that. I think I'd like to have seen that. But I've been very, very lucky. I think I've been on. I'm kind of quoting from my book. I started the book, but I'll never finish it. I've been lucky to. I feel like the Forrest Gump of rock and roll, you know, because I was in Hamburg at the time of the Beatles,
exactly.
And San Francisco, and Swinging London, and Woodstock, and all those things.
Yeah.
And so I have been very, very lucky to have seen that I've been a participant in a lot of cases where all that was happening. So it would definitely be before that. So it would be the 50s. What was happening in the 50s, I think, would be what I'd like to have seen.
That's a great story about the Sun Records and how they signed Elvis and then sold him, I think, to RCA for about $25,000 or something like that.
Yeah. Well, you can only Sam was a good businessman. I guess
right.
He realized that he could only break Elvis regionally to go any further in his career. He needed the distribution, and you know how it all works.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. Then Sam bought shares in Holiday Inns, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Very strange that Elvis never toured overseas, you know?
That's right. Well, that was that story about Tom Parker being an alien, an illegal immigrant or something. Not wanting to go out of America for fear of coming back. I don't know. It is strange. I mean, he did go to Germany. Someone told me that he did a little gig somewhere.
Oh, really?
But I don't know how true that is.
Yeah. He was, what was his nationality? I forgot. He wasn't Turkish. He was, I forgot what he was.
I'm not sure. Maybe East European or something.
East European or something, yeah.
I don't know.
He was afraid.
I've never met him, so I don't know.
Yeah.
I saw Elvis once. I did actually see him before.
You must have met, what's his name? The Led Zeppelin manager.
Peter,
yeah. Yeah.
Yes, Peter was a larger than life character.
Yep.
I got on really well with Peter. Some people found him a little difficult, but he and I got on really well. In fact, at one time, he said to me, if you want to leave 10 years after, just come and see me. I'll manage you and help you put a band together.
Huh.
And he was great. He was a very good manager.
Oh, he was great. He was very good at taking care of his people, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But he was... the first time I met him was when he was tour managing Gene Vincent in the UK.
Oh, wow.
And he used to be a wrestler.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And he went under the name of Count Bruno Elassio. And Richard Coles, Zeppelin's tour manager, used to say to me, you know, you're the only guy that can get away with calling in that because I've seen him hit people for saying that. But yes, he was quite a character. The first guy that, you know, I think the first time that, as far as I know, the first guy that went into a venue when the band got was successful and sold out and got booked back, and he said, okay, we'll come back again, but we want to do it, we want a percentage.
That's right.
Because most times, you know, that percentage thing wasn't happening.
Yeah. Yeah, he took care of Zeppelin for sure. And
he did.
Started with the Yardbirds.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Bad Company, too.
Bad Company, too. That's right. Huh. That's a great story.
Yeah. Well, we all started out together, so, you know, when you do that, you pass cross, you meet each other, and...
Yeah. I talked to Jim McCarty. He was telling me that, let's see, Clapton, Jeff Beck, and Page all lived pretty close to each other in England.
Yeah. Yes, they did. Jimmy lived in... Henley or Goring, Chick Churchill, the keyboard player, with 10 years after lived in Goring, and Jimmy lived just down the road. Clapton was in Henley, or Berkshire, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Berkshire, Oxfordshire border would be where everybody lived. It seemed to be a rock and roll area that people moved to. You know, you go to London, you make a lot of money, and then you move out to the country. It was
right.
that era.
Well, in Birmingham, too, a lot of rockers came from Birmingham.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That's, well, it was always, you know, when I started out, I'm from Nottinghamshire, but I started out, you always had to go to London.
Right.
You know, because that was the center of the music business. You want to be a successful musician, you move to London. And Alvin and I moved down there, I think, 61, something like that. Or 1960 maybe, and it wasn't really until the Beatles had success out of Liverpool that the music business A&R people started looking further afield to places like Birmingham and Sheffield and Scotland, you know, places like that. Wales, some fantastic musicians in Wales, and still is, but. Yeah, but London's a capital city, but it's not. It isn't the be-all and end-all of talent.
Wales is really different, isn't it? I mean, I understand, like, the signage, like, it is really long words, you know.
Yes, it's a different country. It's part of the British Isles, but it's a different country.
Very different.
It's a different language. It's the Welsh language. So everything is in English and Welsh. And you have to learn Welsh in school.
Can you speak Welsh?
No.
Oh, no.
Actually, a few words.
Yeah.
The pronunciation and the way they look, it's such a difficult language.
Yeah.
In the north of Wales, people tend to speak Welsh more often.
Right.
In Cardiff, where I live, is the capital city. So a lot of people speak English as a first language. But everything's in English and Welsh. If you go into a bank, it's English or Welsh.
Yeah.
That's anywhere,
interesting.
Really.
Very interesting.
All the signs, all the bills, your electricity bill comes in English and Welsh.
I remember the Tom Jones show. He always said something in Welsh at the end there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure he did. Well, Tom lived just outside of Cardiff.
Right.
Pontypridd is where Tom came from.
Yeah.
It's a land of song, isn't it, really, when you think about it? Some, you know, great singers have come from Wales.
Oh, fantastic singers. Fantastic singers.
And there's a lot of talent here. But certainly in the city of Cardiff, there are lots of artsy things going on all the time.
I love the history.
It's like Nashville, because it's not necessarily a music business place, but
yeah.
it's a pretty good center for music.
Well, the history itself of Wales and in England, I mean, I'm very much in the castles. So one of these days...
Yeah, you can't go far wrong. I think you could do 10 castles in an hour.
Really?
From where I live.
Wow. I'd love to spend the night in a castle. I think that'd be great.
That's possible.
Yeah.
That is possible. There are several that you can stay in.
Well, Leo, what's next? What's next for you? And is there going to be another recording and a new album coming out?
Yes, there is. I'm thinking of maybe recording the 10 years after 1969 Woodstock set.
Awesome.
If we get time to do that, because a lot of fans would like it.
Yep.
And we're working on a new studio album too, but that probably won't come out until October now.
Oh, fantastic.
And as I said, I'd also like to do an unplugged record.
Yep.
Of course, it's fitting all that in, but that's what I'd like to do. I've got the time, but it's organizing everyone to do it. People do go off and do different things, you know, in between.
Exactly.
Keep doing something new. I'm guesting with some Danish musicians for one show next month, and we are doing the 10 years after Woodstock songs. So that'll be interesting, working with some international musicians that I've not met before and don't know.
Well, it's always a learning process, you know, when you play with musicians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, earlier this year I went to Anguilla in the Virgin Islands and did a blues, international blues show there with a lot of different musicians. You know, Anguilla was the place that the tornado hit.
Right.
Decimated the island. That was an interesting thing too. A completely different culture working with those people. First time I played reggae in my life.
Huh. Yeah, I can see you playing reggae.
I can now. I couldn't get my head around it. I worked with a reggae band, and they said, and you know, that it was, I think there may be five drummers in the band, and I got the idea pretty quickly.
So are you related to Robin Hood, since that's where you were born, or?
Well, I must be, indirectly. Yes, Mansfield, Nottinghamshire, right in the center of Sherwood Forest.
You've got the mustache.
Yes. I don't know maybe the original Robin had a mustache, I'm not sure, but certainly Errol Flynn did.
Errol Flynn, yeah, he was my favorite.
Was he?
Yeah. He was the best Robin Hood, I think.
That's interesting, isn't it? I think I have a Welsh connection too. My great uncle was an opera singer under the name of Morgan Kingston, which is a very Welsh name, although he wasn't actually Welsh. But the interesting story is when he was very successful and on CBS Columbia Records at the time, and I think he was in the Metropolitan Opera Company in New York, and he did a show for Woodrow Wilson, President Wilson.
Oh wow!
And President Wilson gave him a Welsh harp, a gold statue of a let me get this right, an American eagle playing a Welsh. Welsh harp.
Jeez.
So he thought, obviously thought he was Welsh too, but I've always had strong ties with America. I think half my family emigrated to Canada, you know, before the war, before the World War II.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. I always had a something in me about England, maybe in another life or something, you know? I've always been...
I mean, most of, unless you're a Native American, you probably came from... Your ancestors probably came from somewhere else. Most Americans are immigrants, aren't they? So,
yeah. Well, my ancestors came from... My mother's side came from Spain. And, yeah. And my father's side came from Syria. So I got quite a mixture in me there.
Yeah. Well, most people in the UK are immigrants, you know, going back.
Yeah.
Much further than American immigrants, but we're all immigrants. I'm Irish. I come from Ireland.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but you know what? Brits are cool. You know, I mean, you got the history with the knights and, you know, the castles and all that stuff. That's awesome.
Well, it is, yeah. I, you know, America tends to, you know, if it's 50 years old, then they knock it down and build another one, don't they?
Yeah, I know. Isn't that a shame?
I saw my McDonald's being knocked down in Nashville, you know, my local area of Nashville where I live, and I thought, what's going to happen there? And then they built another McDonald's.
Yeah, I know.
It was built so badly in the first place, I think it was about be cheaper to rebuild it than repair it, so the guy said. But.
Yeah, I hate when we knock down famous venues, you know, like...
I know. Isn't that awful?
Oh, it's terrible.
I've got a piece of the floor from Stax Records.
Really?
The old Stax studio, the old cinema floor. I was in Memphis when they were knocking it down, and it was awful, and now they've built a replica.
Yeah. Well, didn't they knock down the Cavern Club, the original Cavern Club, right? Now they got a replica. Yeah.
There's a thing in Cardiff right now where they're knocking down a local venue. They're talking of knocking it down, and people are protesting against it. It's become very political, trying to save these buildings. It happens everywhere. RCA, the RCA studios on Music Row in Nashville, they were going to knock it down to develop apartments, of course. That's usually the thing.
I hate that.
The original Marquee Club, they knocked down that apartment.
Oh, man. That's terrible. That's horrible.
Woodstock stayed.
Yeah.
Killed in Woodstock State. That's something. Although the amphitheater is not on the same spot that the actual festival was, but it's still there.
I guess one day they'll not.
Wars, of course, went. I think the thing is that music usually is in some downtrodden areas.
Right.
Because it's cheaper to rent an old cinema or an old hall than to go right into some latest arts centre.
Yeah. I guess one day they'll knock down Abbey Road Studios. That'd be horrible.
Yeah, no, I don't think they'll do that. I think that's too established.
Yeah.
You know, if you go up the Mississippi to Clarksville.
Right.
I always get the two mixed up. Clarksville.
Right.
It's Clarksville, isn't it? Clarksdale, Mississippi. The Blues Museum there, they've done a little bit more work on it. But when I first went there, there was very little in there because blues musicians of that ilk really didn't have that much to put in the museum, did they?
That's right.
Probably a bit of wood from Muddy Waters' shack. You know, that kind of thing. But they've done it. I've been up a few times since. They are kind of... recognizing the, you know, what a wonderful wealth of music and history that happened around that part of America.
Yeah, you know, a lot of Led Zeppelin's material came from all that.
It did, and they had to pay too.
Yeah.
I mean, subliminally or whatever, I think they had to pay out some, writing legal.
You know, they kind of ripped off the Small Faces a lot too. You know that? I didn't realize that till later. You know, like A Whole Lot of Love came from the Small Faces.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, so difficult, isn't it? Only, you know, there are 8 notes, and subliminally, sometimes you pick up on something.
Right. I mean,
most of the time now, I can hear the first verse of a song and sing the melody for the bridge and the chorus. Because you know where there's so much, I mean, particularly modern music, it's so generic, isn't it? That
yes.
And I, you know, and I've noticed that more. As I said, I, since I've been learning to sing or improving my singing, whatever, I can kind of hit the notes a little bit better. And I think, wow, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
It's not like shooting in the dark. It's just picking a melody that's pretty generic.
Exactly.
So I don't know. It's difficult to say, isn't it? I mean, My Sweet Lord, you know, the George Harrison.
Oh yeah.
Song.
Definitely.
He's So Fine and My Sweet Lord. I know that's a very famous one that George paid out on.
Yeah, that's obvious.
I didn't know George very well, but I don't think he was the type of person
no.
to just go in blatantly rip something off. I think it's a subliminal thing that happens.
Yeah, he didn't have to.
And a lot of the songs that I've written, and my wife will say, she hears the record, and she said, that's they ripped off that song of yours. And I said, I don't think so. It just sounds a bit like it.
Right, right. But there's, you know, there's so much music out there. It's going to happen. You can't help it.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and with sampling now.
Yeah, that's right.
All these programs. I saw a computer program the other week that I looked at, and it was how to write a song. And you put this thing in, they ask you, think of how do you feel? And they give you six different words, and blah, blah. Think of a place, and it gives you the thing, suggestions. You put these things in, and then it says, what genre do you want to write in? And you put blues or rock, or I put Taylor Swift. And they wrote the song, came back with the lyrics like a Taylor Swift song.
Unbelievable.
Apologies to Taylor. For so, I mean, with that kind of thing available, and, you know, the fact that you can cut and paste, and you've got
yeah.
computer programs that play the bass for you, and the guitar, and the keyboards, things are going to sound pretty much the same.
I know, it's a shame, isn't it?
But it's very static and square. A lot of the time, it doesn't seem to have soul.
They don't.
A lot of the pop stuff. There's some great people out there, very talented people out there. But the way they approach songwriting and singing and songs, I can't do it. I cannot do it because I come from a different thing.
Right.
I guess that's music for the young. You know, young people have a different way of doing things, and I'm sure. I know for a fact when I started playing as a raw musician, that knew three chords and wanted to play like bass like Ray Brown. I'm sure those guys thought, "What are these guys? They're getting paid for doing nothing. They're rubbish."
Yeah, that's
so
true.
You know, you have to look at things that way. But no, I wouldn't complain. I complain about the restrictiveness of music now, where people won't play. I mean, they won't play. They'll play a new artist, providing they've got the push, you know, from the record label and blah, 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 blah. But they won't play, a lot of the time, they won't play an old, established artist because,
right.
you know, it doesn't fit in with the idea of, their idea of youth or, you know, it doesn't give kudos to an A&R man to sign some guy that's been successful for 10 years or 20 years or 50 years or however long. They tend to they want to look for something new all the time. It's got to be new. And that's a pity, but I think it's always been like that. One shouldn't complain. I've had a good run, you know. I mean, I thought when I was 25 I was too old.
Yeah, I heard you in an interview say that.
Yeah, I did. I stopped. I thought, I mean, it was the time, what was happening at the time? Rainbow and...
Right.
Yeah, it was Rainbow and what was the other band? I can't think, but bands like that were around. And Rainbow in particular, I was asked if I wanted to join. And I thought, I don't want to go out on the road now. You know, it's not my thing. It's not really the
yeah.
kind of thing. But yeah, some of the guys in Rainbow that I knew, Don Airey and Cozy Powell and, oh, golly, the singer, one of the singers in Rainbow. Golly, I'm terrible on names, do you know? I thought they were brilliant. I just thought I was too old. And I was making making records for other people, so I kind of did that. But so I thought it's don't you think that perhaps some old people should? So one guy said to me, "Why don't you pack up and give someone else a chance?"
Jeez, oh, gotta be kidding me.
Bitter, I think.
Yeah, gotta be kidding me. The singers you were thinking about, Ronnie James Dio and Joe Lynn Turner. Joe Lynn Turner.
The Ronnie guy.
Yeah, know? He was good.
He was brilliant.
Yeah.
And when I was offered the job with Rainbow, I didn't know Ronnie, but subsequently I did know him. But,
you must have known Richie, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
I think it was Richie, Cozy, Ronnie, and Don Airey, I think.
Cozy was a great drummer. He was a great drummer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I played on... Cozy and I were going to put a band together at one stage. But it didn't work out.
Yeah, I saw Cozy in concert. He had his own band.
Yes, he did.
Yep.
Bedlam, he had a band called Bedlam, didn't he?
Yeah, he was good. Well, great band.
He was good.
Yeah.
And Don Airey, I've worked with Don, played on one of my records.
Right.
Not the 170 split, I had a band before that. Don was in that and we toured together. So it's always the same guys keep... Don's in Deep Purple now. But, it was around that time that I kind of thought I was too old and quit.
Well, don't quit. Your music is awesome. We need seasoned rock stars.
I don't know what else I'd do. I think my wife said that I'd just be boring. And I probably would, because I'm boring anyway. I don't really do much other than play music. But no, I love it. I feel animated, you know. I think it gives me energy to do what you love. I mean, I'm sure that's what the secret of life, isn't it?
It is.
Do what you love, you can, and if you're lucky enough to do it, appreciate it.
You know, so many people are in dead-end jobs, and they hate where they work, you know?
They are. I've had good times and bad times, and I remember one of the bad times, my bank manager said, "Oh, I wish I was like you. I've got such a good job and a pension coming, I don't do the things that you do."
Right.
That's when I was trying to get an overdraft, or trying to continue with an overdraft. No, like, or you get in a band, for example, and you want to do something new, and you stay with the band because, you know, it's a good living, and what else can I do?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people do that throughout their whole life.
What, were you friends with Uriah Heep?
Yes.
Yeah. I covered Uriah Heep recently at the House of Blues and hung out with Mick. And I did an interview with Mick.
They did a US tour, didn't they?
Yeah, Mick. Mick
finished doing a tour now.
He looks good. Mick looks really
great.
Good.
Great, yeah. They're doing really well. In fact, I think they're doing better than ever.
It's not the same, though. I grew up with the original Uriah Heep, and I just, it's not the same for me. You know?
I think a lot of people would say that about any band.
Yeah.
Now you remember the original lineup, don't you? And
I was a David Byron fan, so
yeah.
But I still talk to Lee Kerslake.
They did a show at just trying to think where it was, Hammersmith Odeon, I think, in London. A show in London quite recently, a week or so ago, and Lee got up on stage.
He's a good guy.
Yes. Well, he was the right one of the main writers in the band, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I remember them. I remember them coming through.
Well, Leo...
They were with a small label called Bronze when they first...
Yeah.
And a friend of mine was
Bronze
the guy that signed them.
Yep. David Braun, I think, wasn't he the main guy there at Bronze Records?
Yeah. That's right.
Leo, I want to thank you so much, man, for being on the show today. It's a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
I look forward to more great music. Hopefully, you'll make it to the States, because we really miss you over here.
I hope so, too. I'd love to come over. maybe you could come over and do, you know, that we're going to do a Woodstock thing. And I talked with Michael Lang, you know, the guy that did
sure.
the original one.
Yeah.
But I think it's like, I don't know whether Live Nation are doing it or whatever now. And they
right.
want to put, you know, current bands on and new name bands on and all sorts of things. So I don't know. I don't know what would happen. But maybe, you never know. If I can get my permission to enter the United States, I'll do that.
I got to ask you, where did you come up with the name 170 Split?
Well, it was when we were making, you missed one album there, actually. The first album we made was called The World Won't Stop.
Right.
And we recorded it in Nashville, and I live on Highway 100. Highway 70.
Okay.
I had a house on Highway 70.
Okay. That makes sense.
And 170 Split is where Highway 100 and Highway 70
gotcha.
Split. It starts off as Broadway and runs up through Nashville to, and
right.
then Highway 100 becomes Highway 71 and the split goes off to Highway 100.
I got you. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of urban legend too about the name 10 years after. I need you to clear that one up.
Yeah, this is a difficult one because we used to say anything that came in the top of the house, but in actual fact, I came up with the name. I was looking through a newspaper and there was an advertisement for a book about the Suez Canal.
Okay.
1956, you know, the invasion of the Suez
yes.
Canal by Britain?
I do.
NASA closed off the Suez Canal and stopped the boat, so Britain invaded. It was a disaster. But the book was called Suez 10 years later.
Okay.
10 years after, rather.
Gotcha.
And I thought, 10 years after, that's a good name for a band. And I ran it by the manager. We just got a new manager who said, you've got to change your name. And I ran it by him and I ran it by the band. And they said, yeah, I think that's good. So we became 10 years after.
Thanks to you.
But we said it was 10 years after rock and roll and all sorts of things. But the truth is, I just thought it was a book title.
Right. Well, you made some great music over the years, and we thank you for that, Leo.
Sorry, you're going a bit faint.
You made some incredible music over the years, and you're still making incredible music, and we all thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate people still listening to it. We do our best, and our best is yet to come. That's what I tell myself.
There you go. Well, stay in touch so we can follow up with the next album and the Woodstock thing.
Okay. Email me your postal address, and it may be after Christmas now because the mail's crazy,
right.
But I'll send you some of the other stuff.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I'd be pleased.
Thank you, Leo. Have a happy holiday also and a great new year.
Same to you, and thanks, and hi to everybody that's listening.
Okay, cheers.
Thank you, Ray. Bye.
All right, bye-bye, Leo. For more information about Leo Lyons, visit www.leolyons.org, www.facebook.com/leo.lyons.98, also www.10070split.co.uk, or for 10 years after information, www.10yearsafternow.com. Very special thanks to the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news, people. Also, don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, available now at Amazon.com. There's a kind of like a movie trailer about the book. It's on YouTube. It's called Check the G's. Please look at that, and you will learn more about the book. Also, stay tuned. The Rockstar Chronicles. That's going to be my latest book. I'll fill you in on that as we get closer. It's currently in production. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.